It's another Sunday afternoon. Welcome to Wordplay on WBFM, the progressive voice of the mountains. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. With me in the studio today, Greensboro poet Ken Rumble.
Hey, Jeff. How you doing?
Hey, Ken. Thanks for coming up, man.
Good to be here.
Yeah.
Great to be here.
So what you been up to?
Oh, you know, a little of this, a little of that.
A little of this now.
Yeah. I've been working with, I've been doing a lot of writing with a collaborator lately, actually.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, my girlfriend, Anastasia C. It's S-E-A.
Okay.
It's an ocean. Yeah, we've been doing a lot of collaborative writing lately, and which has been really fun. And it's interesting, actually, a lot of the writing has been done back and forth over text message.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it's actually a really interesting form.
Kind of a minimal form.
Yeah, because it's like you have 160 characters, including spaces, and so it's like the modern digital haiku, really, in some ways.
Yeah,
so it's great, and it's great to be, in a very fun, productive relationship.
Yeah,
so,
sure. Certainly beats the other kind.
Yeah, definitely. The weird thing, though, is that we sort of recently discovered that we actually may be related.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How Southern.
I know, exactly. Yeah, it seems that our great grandmothers may have either been cousins or sisters. It was sort of a Civil War thing, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Speaking of Southern, so we sort of discovered this, you know, kind of recently. It was really
That's cool.
Kind of funny. Yeah,
we'll have to make you an honorary mountaineer.
Right. So Annie and I are, you know, we're being careful. So that's a lot of what I've been up to lately.
Oh, well, that's great.
Enjoying Greensboro, which is a great town, actually.
Yeah, you just recently moved to Greensboro from the Triangle. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's really been like 2 years. Actually.
Has it been 2 years now?
But it sort of seems more recent than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So. But yeah, it's a nice little town.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I haven't spent much time in Greensboro since I was in grad school there. Oh, yeah. I went to the program in writing there.
Oh, right.
Back in the heyday of Fred Chappell and, you know, all those guys.
Whose heyday is only recently over.
Yeah,
he's
that's
only
right.
Very
that's
recently
right.
retired.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Long heyday.
Right. Well, Greensboro is great. I mean, it's good. There's a lot going on. There's this place called Elsewhere Artists Collaborative that does some really amazing it's an old thrift store that's been converted into an artist space, living museum residency program. It's pretty amazing. And actually, you can see if you are online and you're looking at the studio and the camera, you can see I'm
our
wearing
cam.
This
T-shirt
that has a little typewriter and this line coming up, and then it says Invisible.
Invisible.
And Annie and I went to see this band Invisible last night, and it's kind of appropriate because it's a great band called Invisible. They're from Greensboro. And one of the instruments that they play is this typewriter, that has been quite literally, they took this, one of the guys in the band with this other guy, built this, adapter, so to speak, that hooks into the typewriter. And then, and on the typewriter are 44 keys. And if you hit the shift, then you then have 88 keys. And so, so you have the whole range of the keyboard of a full size keyboard, on the typewriter. And so like they've kind of built songs sometimes in some cases around words and then, in other cases, you know, around melodies that then got translated into words. So
that's kind of cool.
Yeah. So we had a great time last night. They played a little show, a little community space out in Greensboro.
Good. Yeah. From the T-shirt, I gather that the typewriter is actually a signature for them because that's, you know, otherwise, why feature it on the T-shirt?
Well, actually,
it's a unique instrument.
Well, that's kind of their specialty, actually. This is the typewriter piano is, as I understand it, is really like they sort of do projects, you know, for several months they'll do one project, and like this particular project is centered around the typewriter piano, but they have other kind of, amazing instruments, one of which is I guess I would describe it as an analog drum machine slash music box. But it's this enormous wheel on a motor that has all these holes drilled into it. and you can take pegs and put them in and out of the holes. And as the wheel turns, it trips these LED switches, if there is or is not a peg there. Uh-huh. And then that sends a signal to these little motors that are attached to drums and typewriters and cymbals and doors and all sorts of things. And so when the switch gets tripped, the motor bangs on whatever thing it is. And it really, it's pretty amazing. It's a drum machine.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing. So they're really great. So yeah, Greensboro is a really, really fun little place.
I was actually surprised when I was there back in the, God, how long has it been? The 70s. Mm-hmm. No, make that the 60s. Uh-huh. At the music scene. Because at that time, it had a big jazz scene.
Yeah, and before my time.
Yeah. Right. Probably quite literally. You're such a young woman.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to turning 13. been up to those sorts of things, and
let's hear some of what you've been doing.
A couple other little things about Annie. I guess we'll talk more about me, but I'll just introduce her real quick.
Wish she were here.
She actually grew up next to an amusement park and a miniature golf course.
Cool.
It's really pretty fascinating. And spent a lot of time hiking around, picking mushrooms. She's a mushroom collector, actually.
A mycologist.
Yeah, exactly. And it's pretty great. She did some really great things with them. But now she's down in Greensboro, and she's actually one of the directors of Elsewhere as well. So, so that's pretty neat.
Cool.
And she is a very talented writer.
No doubt.
I'll read some of what we've been doing here. This girl looks at me and says, "You know," and I do know because I know, right? And then it's all that again, and really nice like that. And there was a worm, a warm worm, a worm who cried in the dirt. The dirt was warmer and wetter where the worm cried. Forget the forest. The occasion of the dirt and crying and wormwood happening in the grass, right by your driveway. The nearness was endless. Short lighter, dark light. We are always touching something. There was never a smile so much like birds singing. Seeing them, middle them in your eyes that are like and are eyes. Ash makes light visible. Life light. Yes, the system of sometimes is gray and generous, the blue backwards formed by a shouting whale. We wrote what we intended, and in the holding on came across to our ideas as a stubborn. But the case was closed in the sense the attached lock was in use, but that didn't bother anyone who wanted to continue. There is we and a we in us as like the tend to in intended, the us in we, a we nest. There, the walking backwards on the tightrope on the ground, the space in H. The mountains are getting smaller daily. The subject had already decided not to bother with the blackbirds, a tent of tarp, where you're here backwards, a beam horizontal. Today, the clarinets felt like taking a rest by skipping steps. The stones were finales, rocks as paper measures. Only kin deep, trumpet to trombone, horn to swallow, blick birds to wing tips. How about those orioles? I did not take it, and then it was never there, or no fear. Your fingernails are magnets. I overheard a milk horn, milk, the color of paper. Blip, blip, blip. Let leopards and lions learn to lunge. Oats strewn about. A driver always plagiarizes.
Very nice. What's your process of collaboration like?
Well, we use typewriters and...
You mean actual manual typewriters?
Electric typewriters.
Electric typewriters. Oh, okay.
I have a manual typewriter, and she has an electric one, and then we have sort of two electric ones together, so we have a lot of typewriters.
That's why it looks like TypeScript.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, it's kind of exciting because one of the ones that we one of the typewriters we have, I don't know, kind of my favorite. You can see, unfortunately, those of you in radio land can't see, but it's actually a sans serif font, which
indeed,
I know I haven't really seen many sans serif typewriters. So it's kind of exciting.
That's really interesting. Yeah.
It really changes, you know, the words in an interesting way. But generally we sort of, you know, this stuff is you know, generally we just trade back and forth. And I think, you know, and sometimes like we're writing things that are responses to the other. And then sometimes we're, you know, talking it, you know, in completely other directions. But then also we did a lot of, or one of the things we recently did was I had my eyes shut and she was sort of dictating to me and I was kind of interjecting as I dictated. And so that was really fun to kind of, you know, be writing what she was saying and, you know, rewriting what she was saying and then also like writing my own thing. But but what unfortunately what happened is, you know how on like modern day keyboards, they have those little ridges on the, what is it? The F and G.
Right.
You know, so you know where your fingers are.
Right. Yeah.
They don't have those on typewriters. No. So unfortunately at some point, like towards the end, I misplaced where my fingers were. And so like the last sort of paragraph of this one is Oxolhi Ogger Tir Haurin Gut Gutter Trided Gut Gritum Gut Giat. Anyway, so we're gonna try to translate
the future. Right?
This is the new American language. Yes.
Boy, it's going to be a treat for semioticians. Right.
So I sort of, I've started to try to translate that and figure out what it was.
Yeah, what you were actually thought you were, as it were, typing. Yeah.
But I think I realized that halfway through and I tried to fix it, but then I think it just got worse. So, so I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
But, but it's been really fun.
Yeah. I'm sure. Wow. Do you use the typewriter in your own work as well? What's your process like?
Well, it's been changing a lot. I think for most people, but definitely for myself, my process really changes depending on what is going on in my life. Like, you know, I just try to, you know, I always. Writing is really important to me. Art is really important to me. And so whatever, so I just try to make that fit whatever's going on. And so like right now, Annie and I type a lot. And that's like partially because like we sort of make time to like have at length time. But then in my own writing process, like because I'm working a lot now and just have a busy life, I'm writing in like little small notebooks and I'm finding I'm writing like very short, brief things. And, which has been kind of nice because in the past I used to, you know, well, I had the luxury of having, you know, an hour or a couple hours to just, you know, sit down and write. And now I don't really have that luxury anymore.
Right.
But when I had that luxury, actually getting back to the typewriter question, that was when I first got a typewriter, actually, this old Smith Corona silent manual typewriter. And up until that point, I'd always written in these like spiral bound Mead college ruled, very boring, you know, like 80 cents, 80 sheets kind of notebooks. And I really liked it. It was like sort of my thing. I get into things like that. You know, I had my notebook. I had my very particular kind of pen. For those of you in the viewing and listening audience, it's a Precise V Rolling Ball Pilot pen.
Yes. An excellent choice.
Yes, fine pens. This radio show is brought to you by the Pilot Corporation.
Pintel. Right. And, we have to talk to Pintel about underwriting.
Exactly. Yeah. So I would write in all those. And then I got this typewriter, and I was really excited about it. And I really wanted to use it, but I didn't really know how to sort of fit it into my process. And I don't remember exactly why or how this happened or when I thought of it. But what I did eventually one day is I decided I was going to write with a typewriter. And so I set it up, and probably because I was, you know, worried that I would have it wouldn't the typewriter wouldn't be good for me or something. Like I wouldn't be able to make the leap. I had my little notebook next to me, and You know, so if I needed to bail out,
right, you'd have it right there.
A back door. So I ended up typing a line on the typewriter, and then I wrote a line in the notebook, and then I went back to the typewriter and went back to the notebook, and I kept going back and forth, and did that, you know, for an hour or so. I mean, whatever that writing, that particular day of writing, happened, however long it was. And I really enjoyed it. Like it was really, fun. And it was interesting to see how the, you know, I would write a sentence on the typewriter, and then when I would write it, like what I was writing in the notebook was sort of a rewriting of what was on the, what I'd written on the typewriter, or like a slight alteration, or like, you know, there's just a little bit of tweaking of the original idea. And so, what ended up happening is like the work that kind of came out of that, ended up being, you know, about very small things and about like, you know, well, the main thing that keeps happening is I keep going back to like trying to describe a spoon being in a cup and trying to describe that really accurately. And what was interesting is just the way, like even that kind of simple idea and simple description can just unpack and unpack and unpack and unpack. And, you know, what does that really mean? You know? So, what does that statement mean? How do you really communicate that in an accurate way? And maybe it's possible and maybe it isn't. Maybe just language ultimately breaks down and we just trust that it works.
Yeah. Right. So, most of the time. Anyway.
We hope. So that was sort of, so that was really the birth of my typing, was that project. And that ended up becoming a manuscript called The Monologue for Voices.
Well, in case you're just joining us, this is Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. With me today, Greensboro poet Ken Rumble. And this is 103.5 FM, WPVM, Asheville, North Carolina.
So the, you know,
that kind of tweaking certainly shows up in your work.
Sometimes it's mental tweaking.
right.
Right.
But the neat thing is you include it all.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that you tweak this, you know, line for, you know, 42 times, and then what we see is one line.
Right. Sometimes. Unfortunately.
Right.
But yeah, no, I mean, I think that's like part of the, you know, especially for the monologue for voices, I mean, that's definitely like part of the point and part of the fun is like, just how obsessive that work can be and, how, you know, just how, if something as simple as talking about the position of a spoon is that difficult, then like, what about, you know, human relationships? What about, you know, larger relationships? What about, you know, what are people doing in the world and why, you know, what about the bigger questions?
All the big questions.
Right. Although, you know, sometimes where my spoon is really the biggest question. Right. I really need to stir my cup. So
this work for voices, the monologue for voices, is that new work? Is that a new piece? Is that,
it's not actually
where does that fit in your
exactly
oeuvre?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's it is, geez, I don't know how old it is at this point, a year or two.
Okay,
a year or two old.
So it's after Key Bridge.
It's after Key Bridge, and actually after another manuscript. I guess the monologues is my third manuscript.
So
I was writing this actually, you know, we haven't talked about it, but Lucy Pove.
Yeah,
you
know, I've seen a little bit of
right, the Lucifer Poetics group that I was a part of, or am a part of, remain a part of.
Yeah.
The monologues work really kind of came out of that group and a lot of that time of my life. So like 2003 to 2005 or six.
Right.
And
was that the period of your greatest daily involvement with Lucy Poe, or with the collaboration of Lucifer Poetics Group?
Yeah, I think so. Although,
you had a reading series for a while?
Yeah. Well, that was, although the reading series existed before Lucy Poe did.
Oh, it did?
And the Desert City, I was ran the Desert City, and that actually started in fall of 2002, mm-hmm. I think it was 2002, uh-huh. fall of 2002 in Winston-Salem. Uh-huh. And,
is that where you were then living?
I was then living in Winston-Salem, mm-hmm. and started the Desert City there. And that's actually where the name comes from. Mm-hmm. One of Winston's nicknames is the Camel City. Uh-huh. And so Desert City.
Desert Camel.
Right. Yeah. You know. A little too clever sometimes. Oh, well. Yeah.
The temptation of the poet.
Right, right. But I really liked the name, so it kind of stuck.
Yeah, it's neat. Yeah.
And so I started it there, then moved to Chapel Hill, and that's when, you know, I found various people, Patrick Heron and Joe Donahue, Evie Shockley I knew from mm-hmm. Winston-Salem from mm-hmm. before. And then I met Chris Vidiello, Tony yeah. Toast, Brian Howe, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. All the usual culprits.
Yes, all those great guys. Yeah. So the monologue's voice really kind of came out of that. I think that's like out of all the stuff I've ever written, that's like the most sort of Lucy Poe-esque. Although I would absolutely say that there is no kind of aesthetic that Lucy Poe advocates.
Right.
Even
right.
if they're, well, I would say that there are aesthetics that Lucy Poe criticizes. But there is definitely not one that they advocate. So I wouldn't want to hold this up as being representative, merely just a documentation of a time period.
Right, right.
But yeah, we can...
Well, let's hear some of it.
Yeah, you want to? Yeah, okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, Jeff, I'm going to need your help.
Okay.
Because... Well, it's for voices.
It's for voices. Multiple right. voices.
Multiple voices. Unfortunately, I only have one copy. So those of you watching online, this is going to be exciting. Trying to negotiate all the wires and things here.
All right. Try not to get too tangled up here.
Right. Right. Okay. So you're the parentheses.
Cool.
Okay.
All right.
The sun shines.
I can put down anything.
Two cups today without sugar.
I write with wild abandon.
My coffee cup, jostled by my hand in the act of writing, almost had liquid running down the outside of the cup.
What a long sentence.
Not a sentence, but an exclamation to make a point.
The sun burns.
The process of typing an exclamation mark is fun.
I thought I would write about Todd and Laura and Lisa.
I thought about some lines.
I thought, I'll write, Todd is a beautiful man.
I would go on to talk about beauty.
How I like it.
The sun combusts.
I thought, I am not writing about Todd.
The sun is big, even though it looks small.
June and I took garbage to the dump this morning.
I do not move my legs when I type.
I am right. Todd is a beautiful man.
The sun has no clouds before it today.
We left the garbage there.
I have to pick up Lisa today.
I have a lot to do today.
June said, you have a lot to do today.
I said, I thought you didn't have time for coffee.
The sun, a sphere, even though it looks like a circle, may or may not roll.
I am not actually writing about Todd.
I keep forgetting which line is the underline.
And my rules.
He said, the sun rules the heavens.
Todd said, I was going to wait until Sunday to submit.
I get it all wrong.
I think about writing something else.
I think about writing about something.
I'm still not writing about anyone.
The sun, a large ball of gas, looks like a light shining in your face.
My face.
I once wrote, the garbage smells like bananas.
Todd has a beard.
And it I put it all in there.
And now all the coffee is gone.
There are dots all over the paper.
I think about ways to describe the sun.
I write, the sun shines.
I will write, the sun shines.
The sun actually shines.
The sun shines because I wrote The Sun Shines.
It makes me not want to say things.
The sun actually shines.
I thought I would write more.
Interesting.
Yeah, so.
Live on the radio.
Yes, live on the radio. Live radio.
Oh.
So, yeah, so that's sort of the, you know, there's the work sort of like, stays in that mode for a while. Mm-hmm. Like I think ultimately though some of the people that officially call themselves neo-formalists might get upset. I would call myself a formalist. You know, I don't really write sonnets and things like that. But I think, you know, one of the things I'm very much interested in as a poet and as a writer and as an artist generally is just the way structures are built, forms get built, and then get deviated from, get sort of break mm-hmm. down and sort of constrain things. I mean, one of the things about the monologues pieces is that I really found that what I wrote in the notebook was really very different from what I wrote on the typewriter. Yeah. Ultimately, yeah. Even though they were similar, it was interesting.
Yeah.
And now writing in the small notebooks, of course, like yeah. it's changed the writing up my writing a lot.
Sure. Sure.
So.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm a great fan of small notebooks myself. So
yeah.
I find that I'm using shorter and shorter lines.
Right. Exactly. It's like, wow, why'd you break the line? The page in.
That's right.
yeah, you know, so.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, so.
So, was it last year, 2007,
mm-hmm. yes.
you published Key Bridge,
yes.
which was your first manuscript,
yes.
I guess, your
yes,
first
yes.
project. Yeah.
Well, there is a manuscript before that, whose name I dare not speak.
Oh, yeah? Is it one of the seven deadly words?
No. Damn, that would have been good. I'm not supposed to say that.
We would have to bleep it on the rebroadcast, right?
No, it was just an earlier work, and I found, you know, the sort of tradition that I'm interested in now, the writing tradition that I'm interested in now, which... you know, I don't know. I'm kind of lazy, so I'll just go back to the 20th century. I mean, it's like Gertrude Stein, William Carlos Williams, George Hoppin, you know, people like that, Ezra Pound, that those sorts of folks. That tradition and like the people that came after them, you know, through the last century,
mm-hmm.
I sort of found that tradition when I was getting my MFA. Up at Penn State. And so before then I was sort of reading in a slightly different tradition, which, mm-hmm. You know, it was just different. It was
yeah.
just a different sort
yeah.
of tradition.
Right.
And I found, you know, the kind of Stein Pound kind of lineage, more exciting, more fun,
mm-hmm.
Ultimately. Mm-hmm. And so the manuscript that's before Key Bridge is actually like sort of this, weird, mishmash of like this kind of much more narrative driven verse combined with, you know, kind of more poems that are more like what's in Key Bridge and uh-huh. more like what I write now, which is, you know, kind of mm-hmm. where the pressure is on language and language use rather than mm-hmm. You know, using language as a vehicle for something else, as a vehicle for narrative mm-hmm. or a vehicle as for an image.
Yeah, as though it were some sort of transparent.
Right,
yeah,
exactly.
Right.
Like it's much more about like, look at what words do.
Yeah.
And right. like, you know, they words in language are incantatory. I mean, they make mm-hmm. things exist mm-hmm. that aren't there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's exciting.
Who were the poets you were reading in that first phase?
Well, actually it was, there were four... women poets actually who were really like kind of the first people that I really was like, oh wow, this is wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
One actually is at least part-time Western North Carolina resident, Leanne Brown.
Oh, Leanne.
Yeah, Leanne Brown.
Yeah,
wonderful,
right.
Leanne Brown.
Right.
Her book, Polyverse.
Polyverse,
was,
right.
You know, it was yeah. like I started reading Polyverse and it was just, you know, my mind kind of went through my skull.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
In a really good way. So I was reading Leanne and I was reading Juliana Spahr,
mm-hmm.
Her book, which we'll have to bleep.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love you. Aloha, I love you.
Yeah.
Bleep, bleep. Aloha, I love you. which is an amazing, amazing book, which I love very, very much. And it's really, you know, and I think like Juliana Spahr's work, and then, you know, like soon after that, I found John, the wonderful, wonderful John Taggart,
mm-hmm.
You know, and then both of them, I think, you know, kind of go back to Stein has this real kind of often at times has this real repetitive kind of mm-hmm. permuting kind of way that she writes.
Right.
And I think Taggart and Spahr have both kind of taken that and moved in different directions. But so both of that. So Juliana Spahr, Leanne Brown, Jennifer Moxley. This wonderful, wonderful book called The Sense Record, which is, I don't know if you know it, but it's...
I actually don't know that one, yeah.
It's amazing.
I have to track it down.
It's really great. It's like really kind of post-structuralist, post-modern kind of thinking and philosophy. I mean, it's very informed by Foucault, Benjamin, Lacan, sort of thinkers. But the language and the style and the form that she's writing in is like, you know, it seems like you're reading something like you're reading Wordsworth. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like Wordsworth or, you know, Keats do the history of sexuality, a thousand plateaus. So it's really, I found it really compelling.
Yeah. This sounds worth looking up.
Yeah. Just that mix of like the thinking with this archaic language and really beautiful. I mean, I think that was one of the things that, I really liked about her work is the lyricism of it and mixed with that thinking. Uh-huh. And that those two things didn't necessarily have to be at odds. So them, and then also Lisa Jarnot.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, who also kind of does a little bit
fabulous,
of that.
Fabulous.
Yeah. Yeah, love Lisa. Yeah. And she's coming in September, is that
right? That's
right.
She's going to be in Hickory at the Spirit of Black Mountain College Festival, which is going to be a hoot.
September
25th through the 27th, I think it is, or 28th, one of those. That's going to be a big to-do.
That'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But so I found Lisa's work too, and I loved that, her stuff.
Yeah.
And, So, and ended up kind of actually, I will admit, I've told her this as well, but I also really love the way that she reads her poems, mm-hmm. which have you ever seen her?
Yes.
She's got that very idiosyncratic kind of like stuttering kind of start, stop, mm-hmm. something about the way that she breaks up her poems rhythmically when she reads them, I find really, really great. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. I ripped it off.
Great poet's feel. Exactly.
So.
Listening to Wordplay on WPFM 103.5 FM, Asheville, North Carolina. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. With me today, Greensboro poet Ken Rumble. Ken, I've been a great fan of Key Bridge, and I wondered if we could get you to read a few pieces of it.
Yeah, certainly. We were just talking about Julian Aspar and John Taggart, and the piece I'll read here...
Tell us, before you do that, Key Bridge, of course, is in Washington, D.C.,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
where you grew up.
Mm-hmm. I grew up in Chevy Chase in Washington, D.C., and the reason, or the book came out of, you know, as I was saying, I'd sort of, you know, there's a certain point at which my aesthetic and my interest in various literary traditions was sort of shifting from one to another, mm-hmm. and once I'd sort of leapt out of the other and out of one and into the other, and was still like sort of on my way, you know, still on the surface and trying to go drill into it. Sort of like when I started to write Key Bridge. And so in some ways, the book was an experiment of sorts, like to try to help me think through like what were these people doing with words, and like what did it mean? I mean, partly I was getting that understanding by reading their work, like Julian Espar and mm-hmm. Charles Olson, and speaking in North Carolina, and you know, George Oppen and people like that. Mm-hmm. But then for me, at any rate, like I always find it very useful to write and imitate. I mean, I think I learn
sure.
most mm-hmm. by imitating. mm-hmm. yeah. And so Key Bridge kind of arose out of that point as a way for me to understand this tradition that I was, and these writers that I was getting really excited about and really wanting to learn and understand. And mm-hmm. So it was really great. It was also just like kind of a point in my, you know, sort of history, the narrative of my life, where I was, you know, I just got out of grad school. I wasn't really sure where I was going, what I was doing, and, you know, what I was going to do with an MFA in poetry writing. So, so it was kind of a lot of things. And I went, so I ended up, I think, going back to thinking about Washington, D.C., thinking about sort of my start, I guess, in poetry in some ways, mm-hmm. Which was happened my senior year of high school, and started like just a couple blocks away from Key Bridge in Georgetown. Uh-huh. So there was this little coffee shop that had this weekly open mic poetry readings.
Oh, really?
And it was just amazing. I mean, it was amazing, amazing, amazing. The place was always packed. Every Wednesday night, it was just packed to the gills. People would be like standing outside and standing in the aisles. And
great.
It was amazing. And really good writers. People, you know, it would start at 8 o'clock and people would be there at like 2 or 3 in the morning, still reading and reading and reading.
Sounds like a great scene.
Oh man. Yeah. It was amazing. It was so much fun. So I sort of went back there, as I was sort of in that place. And so that I started writing Key Bridge and just wanted to, try to understand the city and understand myself and, understand what words could do. Mm-hmm. So this particular section, it was actually, speaking of Julian Espar and mm-hmm. John Taggart, I think I wrote this probably the day after or 2 days after I'd seen Julian Espar read for the first time. so speaking of imitating, ripping people off. So, you know, again, you know, that's definitely like one of the things that I do, try to understand things. But, so I'd just sort of seen her read, and her voice was really very much in my head. And, I don't know what else is going on at this time in my life, but this is what I wrote.
All right. Let's hear it.
Dear reader, there is so much to love. There are trees to love. There are roads to love. There is you to love. There is me to love. Sounds like us, even. The trees have bark. There is bark to love. Roads meander or go diagonal. There is meander or diagonal to love. There is so much to love that sounds like us. Sounds bouncing all over everything. The tree with its bark, the meandering or diagonal road. The eyes that watch the sound be made by you or me or you and me together and at the same time on a road or by a tree or by a tree, by a road that meanders, then turns diagonal. There is loud to love. The road that meanders after it is diagonal. The tree that leaves fall by. There are holes to love, whether the bark, the leaves, the roots, the trunk, whether the road, the lines, the pavement, the meander, the diagonal, whether the you or I, the you and I, whether the sound of the road bouncing all over the tree and the tree itself to love. The sound of the birds in the tree, the song of the birds in the tree, the eyes of the birds watching the tree, the road, the you, and the I. There is road or diagonal or meandering. Diagonal and meandering, past trees or no trees, past trees with no birds and leaves, and birds with no leaves and trees, and leaves with no trees, and you and trees or me, and you and me, and the sound of the passing, the eyes and the sound to together, watching or apart to love. There is bark to love. There is loud to love. There are you and me, and you and me and the tree, and you and me and the tree and the road and the birds, and you and me and the tree and the roads and the birds, and together and apart, making sounds. There are places with many roads to love, near places with many trees, to love near many you, to love near many birds, to love near many me, to love near sounds like love, to love. There is bark to love. Rock Creek spills now out between Thompson's boathouse and a white waterfront plaza still there to the Potomac upriver.
The last stanza is grounding it again in the geography of this place. Yeah. I see you've got a much marked copy of Key Bridge.
Yeah.
You've been doing a lot of readings from Key Bridge, I guess.
Yeah. I've been doing a lot of readings, which has been really fun. It's definitely one of the best parts about, you know, having a book is it gives you an excuse to, you know, go out and see the world.
See the world. That's right. That's
right. It's sort of a passport of sorts.
Yeah. It's been well received too.
Yeah. So, it seems so, you know, gotten some good feedback and, you know, it's been fun. You know, it's, you know, I would say that I like the book. But you know, I certainly feel more compelled by my more recent work, but yeah, it's kind of nice.
Always, I
mean,
right.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, you know, sometimes I talk to writers and artists and like, you know, they kind of like hate all their old work and it seems like, I don't know. I mean, it just seems like, you know, it was what it was.
It was what it was, right? Know, yeah.
And it has pleasures. So
right.
It's been nice to have it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, good. Why don't you read us a couple more?
Okay.
When you go out to a reading, what do you like to read from Key Bridge?
Well, I sort of skip around, but what I tend to do is there are several sort of narratives. I think that the book contains like several different narratives and so sometimes, usually what I try to do when I read from it is I try to
give a sense of the,
catch some arc of those narratives. I mean, one of the, you know, I think one of the most obvious and maybe attention grabbing narrative is that, you know, I started writing Key Bridge in May of 2000 and finished it sometime in early 2003. And, you know, and so during that span of time, I mean, there was September 11th, of course.
Right.
Then there was the, you know, speaking of, you know, and in the news lately as well, the anthrax letters that were being sent to D.C. And then also the sniper, the D.C. snipers, Lee Boyd Malvo and John Allen Muhammad. And out of all three of those things, you know, they're all huge. I mean, my parents still live in DC, still have a lot of family there. A lot of friends, DC was really an epicenter for a lot of that. Right. But it was the snipers for some reason that really, I was able to write about them in a way.
Yeah.
So sort of the story about them and their sort of story, is one of the arcs that kind of goes through the book. And I think part of what interested me in that story is that the book is also a lot about, you know, those of you watching on the studio camera, you can see that I am of European descent, Northern European descent. And, so, you know, thinking about like what that meant in a city like DC, which is actually the first city, in the US to have a majority African-American population, in the mid-50s. And I don't know if it's all cities, but certainly DC is a city where, racial identity is like, it's just there. It's just a really kind of thick part of the fabric, to some degree. And so, So thinking about those things as I was writing the book, and then to have, you know, and then, you know, the snipers started shooting and I was having a reaction to that. And then it turns out that they, you know, it was this African-American man and this young man, young boy. That's a young boy.
Yeah. Old boy.
Yeah. Old boy.
Yeah.
But you know, so, so that, yeah, I think that was part of it. It just was like, wow, you know, how it just really struck me.
Yeah.
So that's one narrative. And then, you know, I think that there's also this narrative that of actually birth and death, because the book starts out with I don't know if it's lovemaking, but something in that invisibility and
something in that mood,
right. Yeah. And then as I think the book kind of moves from beginning to end, like there is sort of a transformation from like sort of that physical kind of carnal experience into something that's maybe a little bit more transcendent and a little bit more like love. Like the piece I just read is like closer to the end.
Right.
You know, and then, you know, kind of ends with some of those things. So there's that kind of arc. And so there are a couple of different arcs that I try and pull out.
Yeah.
But yeah, I can read a few more pieces.
Yeah. Let's hear a couple.
Okay. Let's see. I'll read, so the key bridge ended up being like just sort of a grounding point that I would keep, an image that I would keep coming back to and an idea that I would keep coming back to, sort of as, I mean, I guess partly landmark and partly just, anchor and kind of unifying principle. I mean, I think, you know, I mentioned being a formalist and in my ideas about formalism, you know, that they more often than not have, okay, this is really complex.
Language.
That form, actually often has a lot less to do with syllable stress and rhyme and stanzas breaks as much as it's kind of repeating ideas and repeating images and
patterns,
different, patterns of many, many different variety.
Yeah.
So this is a piece that kind of touches on that bridge idea.
Okay.
The bridge, the bridgeable river, bridgely bridging the bridged river. Bridge is, it is, the bridge exists, is exits. Exists is X. The bridge occupies, colonizes, engages, conquers, invades, seizes, maintains, captures, pervades, takes over, storms, grasps, extends, is time and space. Indivisible time, space and form, the bridge, the fluid form of intangibilities. The bridge is, bridge be bridgin'. So yeah, nice. Thinking a lot about, you know, the words and the language and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, and then let's see, I can read a couple more little pieces here. Okay, here we go. Pierre L'Enfant and Ben Banneker walked the avenues, the boulevards, the streets, the roads and circles. They drew the lives they made. Saw or dreamed lives, walked and saw fountains in circles, angles, edges, interstices. North-south the numbers go, 16th, 14th, 12th, 19th, east-west the letters, NPF, SMU. Then two-syllable names alphabetically, Fuller, Gerard, Irving, Quincy. Then three syllables, Allison, Delafield, Jonquil, Rittenhouse. All by alphabet up to the north tip, spent rage for order, until the pattern is left in a tangle of redwood, spruce, sycamore, tulip, and tamarack. Before that, Arcadia. The Capitol building, slave built, the center, the cyclops eye, my dear, dear little monster. This balance, this grid slash northeast, southeast with state names, this monster geometry, dreamed into swampland, L'Enfant and Banneker walked through, seeing city all around, not the web, the veins, the branches, not the swamp, the cracked glass, not the palm lines, not the spokes, the city, the city, the city, seeing all about the city.
That's very nice. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, and that's, you know, I think that's part of the attraction of DC is it's, well, I guess like most cities, but I think DC in some ways maybe a little bit differently because, you know, I mean, DC really was just a swamp until, right. you know, Pierre L'Enfant
decided to drain it,
right.
build the capital.
Right, exactly. You know, so it's, so there's like a real kind of logic and formalism to the way the city, the streets are named and laid out and all of those sorts of things. So, so it's really a very, yeah, very formal place.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's, I mean, probably the first city in the United States, to have been planned. I mean,
Maybe really. Yeah.
I don't know, but yeah.
I mean, I guess Philly would be before that, but yeah. I mean, did they plan Philadelphia?
You certainly couldn't tell it.
I mean, I really like Philadelphia. They've been very good to me there.
It's a good city. Yeah, right, great
it
city.
It is a good city. Yeah. It's a great city. Oh, and actually, could I read a little piece
sure.
for this? This I just want to dedicate. It's very small, very, very brief piece. Yeah. But I want to dedicate it to an Asheville resident, good friend, fellow Lucifer Poetics group member, Mr. Shaul Gray.
Oh, Shaul. Yes, who, he was on the program
right,
a few
right,
weeks
just
ago.
A couple weeks ago, right? Yeah. Yeah. So this one goes out to Shaul.
Excellent.
So this is from the 27th of February, 2001. I'm so hung over, I could eat a live cat and feel better. So I think he was out last night. He called me this morning. That one's for you, Shaul. So, yeah. So I guess I can maybe read a couple more pieces.
It's an interesting mix of shorter and longer pieces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it really, you know, it's funny, or at least to me, it's funny because sometimes people will say they're, you know, the book is sort of broken up or they're sort of split up by the date, and the dates are the date of the original sort of composition.
Yeah.
But they're not actually arranged in chronological order. I mean, they kind of are, but then they start to, that kind of starts to break up.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's, what's funny to me is that sometimes people that have read the book are like, oh, you know, they kind of, they actually know the dates better than I do. Like I can't identify. I don't even remember what the days are.
Yeah.
So like,
is there a reason you didn't title the poems? I mean, do you not title poems?
I tend not to title poems, I wouldn't say that. What I would say instead is that I tend to write poems that are like about 70 to 80 pages long. So, I mean,
you just work in extended form.
Right. So, I mean, I think Key Bridge
is the title.
Yeah. Key Bridge is the poem's title. And then all those dates are just, you know, they're like chapter headings or something like that.
Okay.
So,
all right.
You know, like the monologue for voices is, you know, I mean, they're 50 or 60 pages of it, and you know, and I don't just, but they do change. I mean, they're broken into sections, but I don't distinguish them at all.
Right.
You know, it's all like kind of a piece for me. Here's another one. Cold Thanksgiving, still all. Tomatoes won't grow now, but we thank them. Thanksgiving, the question being, to whom? And, of course, where? I thank you, Amos, Violet, Heather, Mom, Dad, Anne, Johnny May, Lily. The place of giving, the place to which something is given. A receiver, something still, out of the movement. They say the universe ends when it stops. Cecil, Jim, Charlotte, Robin, Lyra, Matthew. They say that stars orbit each other, that looking out, away, into the dark and light of the night, that looking out from the city, or what have you, that looking at this sky and seeing two near stars paired, pinpricks of white in this black sky, this night, and seeing these stars, that seeing them, the afterimage of them, that they could be compared. the man and his boy. His boy doing all the killing. Orbits and absence, the lack of straight lines in this hyperbolic space. Hugh, John, Sonny, Mark, David, Evie, Lisa, Jennifer. That sight is a measure, the lean and sway of each path, the sight as a metaphor for a path in our sphere, binary stars and a black man and a black boy, the far metaphor, that other unknowable metaphor, that the distance between self and objects, the distance that you measure it, the travel from light to another, stars and magazines, Jody, Kathy, Sam, Joe, Will, Catfish, Sam, Sherry. The city left with the in and outs, the city holding you still. It's cold there today, I know, cold all through the Potomac like metal. I put my thanks in Washington. D.C., the ease of it all.
Nice. Hmm. Well, Ken, we've got time probably for one more.
Okay.
Yeah. What would you like to finish with?
Yeah. Let me read a little bit more of the collaboration that Annie and I have been working on.
That's great. That'd be a great.
Yeah. Very, you know, and I guess that's the other thing is about my work generally. You know, I say I write like 70 page poems. My poems are all like 70 pages long. And I think part of that is because like from project to project, like the voice and tone really changes and the form really changes. Like I really, you know, the writing that's in Keybridge, I think is really different from the writing in Monologue for Voices, which is really different from the stuff I've been writing on my own. And then also again, very different from the stuff that Annie and I have been working on. So I'll read this. This is the piece that she was sort of dictating and I was blindly typing.
Okay.
Wrinkle at work. A drawer for a horn help cusp almost there. Pattern on the a farm for animals and options or rather opinions. Make the heart grow fodder. The echo on the riverboat while there is a corn on the cornbread. Corn red rather. Doesn't connect things. The color of abseiling and is never unglued. Periscope pills, apple, lost a nod in the other direction. Orthopod, the bracket, brackish, maybe when, maybe does not, maybe does not, maybe female deer gate mosaic. For after the molding marsupials. Comet talk, what a cake made of clay. A dog wrong. How many numbers since we last left them? The dog can say, I love you. Elise. Clothed finger top hinge held a flavor elbow crook. Simple rhombus samples surround us. Shy trapezoid. Needle nose pliers. After school players. The movie about when it was not that thing. Of chickens. Socks in the chicken. Apples on the crabs. Talk to me, Mama, about the gas in the can. Underbred storage. All the rage.
Nice. You've been listening to Greensboro poet Ken Rumble. This is Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. Tune in again next week.
Thanks a lot, Jeff.
Thanks for coming up, Ken.